to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. Hi, Mom.
Hi. Nice weather.
So Mom's in Iowa. I'm in Texas today, and I believe that our guest is probably in Portland, Oregon, since that's where she lives. Mom, do you? Ellen Michelson is a physician in Portland, Oregon, and an MFA graduate from Pacific University. Her work has appeared in Creative Nonfiction, Portland Monthly, Women in Solitude from the SUNY Press, and Literature in Medicine. And this is her first book. The title is The Care of Strangers, and it is a novel. It won the Miami Book Fair Prize for novella from the DeGroote Foundation. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Ellen.
Thank you.
So, have you been writing your whole life?
Yeah, I guess so. When I think back to elementary school, I was writing little poems, and I was editing a little school paper, editing the boys' comments on with sports jargon because I had no clue what I was doing. And then I remember, and my father would, when I wrote little poems, he'd say, "No market for poetry, no market for poetry." And then I was writing for the school paper.
Wait,
in high school.
At what age your father was telling you there was no market for poetry when you were writing poems as a child?
I don't think he said that as a child, but I think it was later, yeah, because he wouldn't say that as when I was a kid. But but yeah, that, it just came to me that he used to say a few things. I didn't get a huge amount of encouragement. He was a writer, and he had a delayed kind of, you know, career. He actually left his job when I was 10 years old to write, and he had a musical review that was in Bourbon Street in New Orleans, and then he had a screenplay that floated around Hollywood for years, but he tried to bring the musical review to New York City, and I guess he couldn't get funding or whatever. It didn't fly, but yeah, it did well and was reviewed in Variety and all that. So, you know, it was
wow.
A hard life. You know, it was it's a hard life to be a writer and not have another profession. So no one really encouraged me to go that way.
Well, was your father making a living as a writer?
Yeah, I guess he made a living. I mean, you know, I think his move to New York led to my parents' divorce, but he didn't make a lot of money as a writer, no. I mean, you know, he had been working in public relations before he decided to quit his job and go to New York. So he had supported us with that job. But we didn't get too much support from him financially.
With all of that, why did you decide to write?
I've never told that story in public before. I don't know how that came up. I'm being spontaneous. I really always liked it. And then I started writing stuff, and I guess it really kind of started more. Well, yeah, in college, I wrote essays and for school, and I always really enjoyed it and did really well. And then when I was in medical school, I started writing some stuff, and sometimes I was depressed and I wrote, "Oh, woe is me, I'm depressed again." And then I got really tired of writing that and hearing it. And somewhere along the line, I started trying writing fiction. If I saw myself as a fictional character and wrote about something else, that was better, you know, and it was more interesting and more useful and whatever that. And then I don't know. When did I really start writing fiction? I mean, as soon as I finished my medical school training, I signed up for a writing workshop. So I guess it was sort of in there, but I didn't pursue it seriously. It's taken me a long time to take myself seriously as a writer.
And you're still working as a physician as well?
I am, yeah. I work part-time so I can write, and I'm in a transition now where I keep cutting back a little bit more. And since the book came out, I haven't been focused on promotional stuff and other things, and I haven't got back to writing yet, but it's going to happen soon.
Well, tell us a little bit about The Care of Strangers and what it's about and what inspired this story.
What inspired the story? Well, it's about a lot of things, but it's about how we take care of each other in challenging times. And it's also about how we get beyond our family expectations to be who we want to be or to do what we want to do in life. It covers a lot of other things. It's about hierarchy in the hospital, mother-daughter relationships, female relationships at work, and it's also about the immigrant experience. The main character is an immigrant.
What's your experience with that, with being an immigrant?
Well, I am not an immigrant. I'm a second-generation Jewish person, and I guess I stole a few details a little bit from a man I was dating and engaged to many years ago, who was a Polish Jewish immigrant, and he had come to this country when he was about 6 years old. So I sort of stole that little piece of his life, and gave it to my character Seema. You know, that's about as much as I personally know about immigrant life.
Well, you said you're second generation, so that means your parents were immigrants?
No, my grandparents were.
Your grandparents. And did they talk about it at all?
Not really, no. I mean, my grandfather came when he was just a child, and all he talked about how, you know, he was one of eight kids, and you know, how he was out on the streets when he was 10 years old selling newspapers to make some money. But that's about it. No, they didn't. It's funny because thinking about it now, I don't exactly know why I chose an immigrant per se, but I did.
Because that's actually a pretty important part of the story.
It is an important part of the story. And I think, I mean, part of the thing, like people have asked me why write from the point of view of an orderly. And I think it goes along with the immigrant reason is that an orderly as well as an immigrant is an outsider. And I'm really writing about outsiderness. And those two things, Seema's immigrant experience makes her even more of an outsider. And she wants to be an insider. She really wants to be an insider. And she doesn't know if she can. She has a slight accent because she's been in this country since she was about six. And now she's in her 20s. And people think, oh, you know, where is she from? But you really can't tell. She doesn't. It's not identifiable. It's very slight accent.
And also an important part of her identity is being Jewish. And does that make her an outsider in this environment too?
Well, it does and it doesn't. She's in New York City, so New York City has more Jews than any place else in the world. So she's not an outsider in the larger world. She is an outsider in the hospital world, in this inner city hospital world, which is largely also made up of immigrants. A lot of people from the Caribbean. She actually, in a lot of ways, connects better with them, identifies more with them than the doctors who come from fancier homes, and they're all, native born, and they have family support, which she doesn't have as much of, even though, you know, her immigrant experience is really quite different than, she's not from Jamaica or Trinidad, and she's white, she's not black. But she still identifies with their struggles and with the difficult lives they've had, even though she doesn't know as much about them in terms of that.
The word orderly, does that? Mm-hmm. It seems to me like they should be the ones keeping things in order by the name. Mm-hmm. Is that true or not?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. I don't know where that word comes from, but orderlies. Orderlies basically are a lot of gophers. You know, they do a lot of things. They run around the hospital transporting people. They bring patients to X-ray and to the lab and bring them up from the emergency room into the wards. Sometimes they deliver things around the hospital, lab tests and lab results. And so they're really they're sort of they're helpers, really. They don't. And I don't know why they're called orderlies. I don't know. That's a good question. I should look that one up. But no one's ever asked that before.
They're certainly very crucial to the running of a hospital. I must say that.
Absolutely. And you know, I've done different sessions like this, some book groups, and it's come up that, you know, people that ancillary staff in hospitals really do a lot. And you know, all the shows, most everybody focuses on the doctors and the nurses and all the drama that goes along with them. But there are a lot of other people that behind the scenes that aren't so, you know, don't have fancy titles and don't wear stethoscopes or white clothes or a special uniform. And they're very important, and they can make a big difference in patients' day-to-day living, also in the hospital.
Yeah, right. Especially in this particular hospital. This hospital is kind of different. You want to explain that a little bit?
Sure. It's a big, huge inner-city hospital based on a big, huge inner-city hospital in New York in the center of Brooklyn, and it's 26 buildings spread out over several blocks. I don't know. A lot of inner city hospitals are big. I don't know if this is the biggest or one of the biggest, but I can imagine that it is. It's a rough and tumble kind of place. Somebody criticized once that on Goodreads said, you know, doctors drawing blood. I don't believe that, you know, but actually we did back then. The interns drew blood. We didn't have any blood drawing teams. I'm sure they do now, but we did everything. And in fancy city hospitals in Manhattan, there's people hired to do all sorts of stuff. And in the bigger inner city hospitals, we were on our own to do a lot of things. They're not well funded. They're more run down. I think the county has been renovated probably a couple times since I've been there, but we had wide open wards. The big ward that held, I don't know how many, 20 people. I'm not sure how many beds there were. And then we had smaller wards that had 6 beds. And then the only one bedded rooms were isolation rooms when we needed to isolate a patient. So that's quite a bit different from most hospitals today, and I don't know that they still have the big wards, and most places have two rooms that have 2 beds.
Now there was also prison ward.
Yes, there was a prison ward that was on the third floor, and we had prisoners from Rikers Island. And who needed medical care, and I had to go to the prison ward quite regularly. And you asked me to read something. I think I will read that piece because it's pretty interesting.
Okay.
And it's about the right size and all.
Well, why don't we do that? Let's do that.
Great. It gives you a little bit of a flavor. Seema didn't spend all of her time in the prison ward, and neither did I. You know, you asked also what was the about the content of the book. I mean, it's loosely based on experiences when I was an intern there. But I can't remember what I made up and what I didn't make up anymore. I used to remember, but it's all a blur at this point. So I will start. This is chapter 3, and as you know, Seema's she's an orderly, and she's gone to the prison ward to fetch a patient. And that's, I think, about all you need to know. But she meets an important character in here who is important for the rest of the book. Prison ward. The door to the prison ward slammed behind her, and she was in a cage without windows. No telephone on the wall, no doorknobs, no way in, no way out. She felt small, an expendable nobody, foreign-born, not a Gentile. Seema braced herself the moment the second rusty metal door closed her in, before the third one opened and shut, and she was as deep as anyone could be, locked inside the county. There was a knuckle-shaped dent in the middle of the third door. Above the dent was a small window at the level of her chin. A broad-chested guard with a gun in a holster sat high up behind the windows. Black bean eyes and a tip of pink tongue stuck out between dark lips. His fingers gripped the silvery neck of a microphone. Hospital ID, he said. She lifted her name tag up on her shirt pocket. Orderly Seema. Orderlies didn't write last names. She wondered what would happen if she lost her ID. Ridiculous thought. She hardly had to prove she was an outsider. Closer, the guard said, his words breathy through the microphone. I was here last week. She resisted the urge to roll her eyes. She unclipped her badge and held it up against the window. The guard buzzed her in. She pushed her stretcher down the hallway, wheels squeaky on the scratched linoleum, past more guards with holsters and billy clubs posted every 10 feet. The ward was at the far end, behind a wall of windows, ceiling to floor. A guard stood by the locked door. The nurse's station was its own windowed cage with a separate secure entrance. "Peabody," Seema heard a woman's voice announced from a microphone. "Nurse Bingham." Nurses rated no first name. Three doors down on the right, she nodded to the guard by the entry to the ward to let Seema in. "You know the drill," the guard said. Inside, the open ward was filled with dark, moody men doing time at Rikers, street sick from drugs, from gunshot wounds and stabbings, and deeper wounds, the kind nobody could see. She was drawn to these strangers in a way she didn't fully comprehend. She was drawn to county patients, wherever they came from, whatever they had lived through. A husky guard inside the ward stepped beside her, smelling of mustard. "Stay alert," he said, then stationed himself against the windowed wall, where the move of every prisoner was watched by the guards on the other side. "We got ourselves another pretty little whitey here," a grumbly voice shouted. "Why don't these nice lady doctors wear skirts? Show a lonesome man a little leg." He shot up out of bed and suddenly was up close to Seema. "Hey, hey," he said. "Watch it," the guard said, his words out in the air like a cartoon bubble. The grumbly voice laughed again and others joined in. Fluorescent lights buzzed from the ceiling. Seema leaned into her stretcher and moved away down the aisle between two long rows of beds. The stink, the schmod, was worse than in the women's ward. Dirty socks and seeky piss. She breathed through her mouth. She stopped where an intern stood over the prisoner she'd come to transport. She'd seen this intern on another ward. Up close now, Seema thought she could see herself, a young woman with curly dark hair, narrow shoulders, long arms and fingers, except for the glasses and the white jacket. The young doctor's pockets bulged with test tubes, wrapped gauze pads, syringes, rubber gloves. Her chest pocket was overstuffed with note cards, her pager on the verge of falling off the waistband of her white on-call pants. Mindy Kahn, M.D. Her ID didn't say she was a psych rotator, spending a year on medicine. Seema had heard the other interns talk. This doctor wasn't anyone she wanted to be mistaken for. The prisoner sat up against his pillow, his hospital johnny laundered pale, its neckline crooked. He yanked his arm out of the intern's grip. "Shit, man," the prisoner said. "How many times you going to poke me?" "It would be nice if you had some veins, Mr. Peabody." Dr. Karn's demure smile seemed forced. She had one hand on the prisoner's forearm, the other on a tourniquet cinched around his bicep. "Mr. Peabody," he smirked. "Mr. Mars Peabody's got veins. You just got to know how to find them." He turned to Seema. "What are you looking at?" Sores the size of quarters covered the man's arms. He sat on top of the sheets. Hospital bottoms rolled up to his knees. Red wounds ran up one leg and down the other. The interns joked that the psych rotator wasn't any good at procedures. She wasn't expected to be. But getting blood out of this attic was going to be a challenge for even the best medical intern. "What's the matter, Doc?" he said to Seema. "Mars Peabody's veins too tough for you?" Then his raspy laugh turned into a cough and a wheeze. "Give him another pillow," the grumbly voice three beds away spoke up again. "The doctor needs to listen to his lungs," another prisoner taunted. "Sit up," Seema said to Mars Peabody. She stepped in close to the bed, reached behind his back with one arm, tilted him forward and held him tight. "Take a deep breath," she said. Dr. Kahn stood by Seema's side. "I need to listen to his lungs." "Doctor, doctor, doctor," a chorus chimed in. "Pillow, pillow, pillow." Another guard Seema hadn't noticed was walking down the line of beds. "This ain't no joke," he said. "Peabody can't breathe. Shut up and let the doctor do her job." Dr. Kahn stood there, arms hanging by her sides, the way her stethoscope hung from her neck, paralyzed by the voices in the room. Seema kept her hands on Mars Peabody's shoulders. The laying on of hands, what she'd read a doctor was supposed to do, what Dr. Kahn needed to do now. Chief Danielson had taught Seema to listen to breath sounds. She wished she had her own stethoscope. "Sit forward," Seema heard herself say. "Take a deep breath." She could feel his ribs move, the vibration of his wheezing. Dr. Kahn placed her stethoscope onto the patient's chest. "Deep breath," Mars coughed and wheezed. She listened carefully at several places on his chest. "Smaller breath," she said, listening from the front and the back. "Slower." Mars Peabody's breathing eased. Seema couldn't hear his wheezing anymore. She could feel his shoulders relax, and then she felt him squirm forward from her touch. He closed his hand around the tubing of the stethoscope and stared up at Dr. Khan. My lungs are working just fine now, he said. They eyed each other, Mars Peabody and Mindy Khan, M.D. Time to get that blood you want so badly, don't you think, he said. Dr. Khan broke the stare and removed his hand from the stethoscope. I don't think so. You just got to know how to feel for it, Mars said. He grabbed the tourniquet from the bed sheets. I can teach you a few things. He wrapped the tourniquet around his arm, anchoring one end and leaving the other loose. He took the loose end between his teeth and tugged. Syringe, he said, through the yellow rubber in his mouth. Come on, he snapped his fingers of his free hand. You got all them needles on that table. Hook up a big one for me. I don't think so, Dr. Khan repeated. Seema watched as Dr. Khan reached for the anchored end of the tourniquet and yanked it as if she'd been doing this her whole life. The yellow tubing snapped against Mars' skin as it fell off his arm, the other end still held by his teeth. A strip of skin, reddened by the tourniquet, stood out from the many sores on his arm. Mars winced. He fingered the bruised spot, then he pressed deeper and deeper again, almost frantically. He shivered and buried his hands under his armpits and rocked. The tourniquet lay abandoned on the bedsheet. Time to get you onto the stretcher, Mr. Peabody, Seema said. Mr. Peabody, Mars said. Mars Peabody. He pulled the bedsheets tightly around him.
And that was Ellen Michelson reading from The Care of Strangers. So the level of detail in really throughout the whole book is pretty incredible. If this is based on your experience as an intern, of course, that was a few years ago. But is this something that you're still, are you still like in this environment where, or how do you remember these details?
I'm a detailed person and I have a very visual memory. And I sometimes in the earlier drafts of this book, early criticism that I just got stuck in details and forgot about the story because I just get immersed in writing what I see. And, you know, I'm still a detailed person. I think it's just the way I'm wired. I don't work. And now we have hospitalists. I hardly even go into the hospital anymore. So I wouldn't be able to, you know, I'd have to go and spend some time in a new hospital or a different hospital to remember now what the details are. But, you know, when you live this, when you're working as an intern and trainee, you're in the hospital 100 hours a week. At least I was, my generation of doctors was. And so the details are just in your face. And I mean, that's what you're living all the time. So it's not hard to conjure them or to bring them to life. At least it wasn't for me. It hasn't been for me.
Why did you become a doctor?
Why did I become a doctor? You know, I could see my parents were divorced and I wanted to be able to support myself. And I wanted to do something that was useful. I thought a lot of jobs, you know, when I was young, I mean, I thought a lot of jobs were stupid. They weren't very important and they weren't very interesting. And I wanted to do something that was going to matter and to take care of myself. And I also wanted to do something that women didn't do. I mean, in my era, they let us in. About 25% of my class was women. Now it's about 50%. It's been that way for a long time. But my mother had wanted to go to medical school when she was young, and she ended up going to graduate school for a couple of years. But they didn't accept her to medical school, and that's what she really wanted. But she was two women in the whole class of her whole class. And she went to Yale. She wasn't stupid. She was very smart. But, you know, I never asked her. I guess she must have applied to medical school. But, I don't really know, to tell you the truth. I never thought to ask her that. And she has passed away. But she found it, you know, it was tough. She dropped out because she felt she wasn't doing very well. And years later, she found out she was doing very well. And she had master's plus 60 credits or something for a PhD, but she didn't want to do research. She wanted to be a clinician, but it was tough, very tough in those days to be a woman in a graduate program of any sort. They didn't make it easy.
Right. Well, even in you know, your generation, mm-hmm. not that many women thought to become doctors. It was sort of a little bit we didn't have a lot of role models.
We didn't have a lot of role models, no. But for some reason, yeah. Everybody, when I was applying to medical school, everyone wanted to be pre-med. And 50% of my class started out pre-med, and I went to Brandeis University. 50% started out pre-med, of course. They weeded a lot of people out, and I think about 85 of us ultimately applied. And then there was a short period when I was in New York at Mount Sinai that they said that getting an MBA became more popular than becoming a doctor, but it was a short thing. I think a lot of people have always wanted to be doctors, I guess that's why it was a time when women were doing stuff and women were doing whatever they wanted to do, and everybody around me was pre-med. So I actually didn't study in the science library because I couldn't stand seeing all these pre-meds around. The competition was, I didn't want to know about it. I just wanted to do my thing. So I studied somewhere else in the college. It didn't feel that difficult or challenging to me any more than it would because so many people were doing it and lots of women were applying at that time.
Now, what is the time setting for the care of strangers?
It takes place in the 80s, in the very early days of the AIDS epidemic. And there's one little chapter about an AIDS patient. The book is not about AIDS, but it takes place in that era. And what was particularly significant during that time was that because we were drawing blood on patients when I was an intern, we were potentially exposed to the blood of people with AIDS and the infectious disease people. Certain people would chase us around the hospital, trying to make sure we were safe. And we also had a TB ward. There had once been a whole building that was a TB sanitarium many years ago. And one person, my PPD became positive from being exposed to tuberculosis. We had to go onto the TB ward, but because we had a hospital full of immigrants, TB was a common illness that we considered on anybody who came in with a fever and a cough. We had to rule out TB on them. But the time with AIDS was also this was very early on in that time period.
So you had saw the beginnings of the AIDS epidemic, and then you were in Portland, mm-hmm. which was kind of one of the hot spots for the COVID, mm-hmm. the initial COVID epidemic. Were there? Did that?
Yeah.
Did you have flashbacks?
Yeah. Well, the very first cases I think were in Washington State, which was right near yeah. us. So we weren't the first. There's some similarities and differences. I mean, it's an illness that's very serious that can be deadly. different people. I mean, everybody is potentially a target for AIDS for COVID. And yeah. when people get it, many people become very, very ill and can die very suddenly. Nobody dies from AIDS overnight. But it's also different. It was restricted to certain populations. And we used to talk about they talked about the four H's when I was, that changed over time, but the four H's, I hope I remember them all. Hemophiliacs, homosexuals, Haitians were in there, and there was another one. I'm forgetting what the fourth one was, but so we knew that it was, you could get it from certain ways, but people early on, people were afraid to like drink out of a cup that their son had AIDS. They didn't want to drink out of a cup that he drank from. And, there was a lot of hysteria, a different kind of hysteria. Here and there's a little chapter in the book where an AIDS patient gets in the elevator and a Haitian AIDS patient and the hospital police are afraid to touch him. They don't want to take him out of the elevator, and they call Seema in to help because she translates. She's good at talking with people, and so the nurse at night called Seema to help get him out of the elevator. And the other differences in the AIDS versus COVID. I mean, when people, and we talked about this at one book club, that with COVID, people, everybody's gowned and masked, and the intimacy and the connection, ability to communicate with patients and staff and family and everybody was so limited. People, it's really hard to, there's boundaries to intimacy that's not true. There's boundaries to intimacy with AIDS patients, but that's different. But we would, you know, we had to wear gloves and be careful. We didn't have to wear masks particularly unless we were doing something sterile because AIDS wasn't transmitted that way. But early on, we didn't really know. Like same as with COVID, we didn't really know the bounds of the disease and how people got it and how people could keep themselves safe from it.
Right. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Ellen Michelson, author of The Care of Strangers.
I didn't know when this book came out, and in a lot of ways it's come out at a very good time. I mean, it's hard to release a debut in a pandemic, and everything is virtual, and I don't see people in person, which is really hard and challenging. But some of the issues are clearly relevant to now, and it's kind of shocking in some ways how relevant these things are, even though this book takes place 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, that the immigrants and all sorts of things are still very relevant. And how we take care of poor people, healthcare, women in a workplace, you know.
The whole bit,
which is why I appreciate and like to do these things, because every time I do one, and you've brought up, you've made ask different questions, and it's just, you know, it's still, I don't know, I shouldn't be so shocked or whatever, but I, as a writer, I never really thought of how people were going to respond to my work and to what I'm writing about, and every time I'm like, oh wow, this is so interesting, I'm really glad, and I'm appreciative when people respond to things that I was just writing a story and what I knew and wasn't thinking about necessarily honing in on, you know, some of the things that people brought out. Clearly, I know I'm writing about healthcare in an inner city and an immigrant, but other things come up, like the importance of ancillary people to the care, to the care of patients. Yeah.
One of the themes that you deal with in the book is anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, it was kind of shocking to me. Okay, so Sima, she and her mother fled from Poland in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize it would have been so bad.
Yeah. Well, Poland had a pretty bad, they were not good characters when it came to World War II and the Holocaust. They weren't very kind to Jews. Other countries helped Holland, other places I won't list because I am no expert on that, and I would probably not say the right thing. But this a little bit I stole from my partner, fiance, at the when I started this is there was a lot of anti-Semitism in Poland, and there weren't that many Jews because a lot of Jews were either killed or fled, so there was still anti-Semitism, and that had a big impact on her life growing up, for sure.
But even to the extent that a doctor wouldn't help a Jewish baby,
that was so sad.
Yeah, I mean, I made that up, but I've heard from people that actually did happen. Her baby brother died because a Ukrainian doctor wouldn't touch him. Yeah.
Now she was told that she would be probably really good as a translator, and might be able to, you know, get a job doing that. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, she one of the head nurses, because she's always seemed to intervene with patients, and she did well with people who couldn't communicate that well. And so they suggested, yeah, she could be a translator. I mean, in those days in the inner city hospital, I mean, we didn't have translators, but now I regularly have translators. I have a bunch of patients from Russia and I have a bunch of Chinese patients, and they always come with translators. So we can communicate with them. Yeah. But in those days, there were no translators that I was aware of. I didn't, when I worked at Mount Sinai, I didn't see them up there either. I don't think that was a thing back then, but now if you're foreign, you speak a certain language or various languages, you could get a good job as a translator. Absolutely.
What kind of medicine do you practice?
Internal medicine, primary care, like when you go to see your adult doctor, you see somebody like me. I see adults. I don't see, I've seen some teenagers, usually children of patients. I don't have any right now. But that's who I see. I don't do surgery. I don't deliver babies, and I don't see kids.
And on your book, you don't have Dr. Ellen Michelson. Why did you choose not to do that?
That's interesting. And no one asked me that, even the publishers. Nobody ever said, they would just ask me, do you want to be, how you want to be introduced when I do an event? Because when I write, I'm writing as Ellen Michelson. I come with a deep knowledge of what I've done, and I can speak with authority on that. And even in the early days when there was problems with the story, no one questioned my authority and the details. But I'm writer Ellen Michelson, as we sit here. Can't divorce myself fully from the doctor, but I'm a writer. Yeah.
Now, we have, over the years, we've been doing this since 2006, and we've had a number of other physicians mm-hmm. who have written novels mm-hmm. over the years, everything from, science fiction to, just all kinds of different things. Do you think it's common? Are there a lot of doctors that who write in their spare time? And if so, why do you think that is?
Well, there is historically, there is a doctor writer presence in the world. I'm going to forget who some of the doctors are. I don't know if Chekhov is, but there are quite a few doctors who are writers. And why? Abraham Verghese is a more modern one that comes to mind. We see humanity in all its shapes and all its forms, good and bad and everything in between. We pay attention to details. We hear stories. Stories are a big component. Mm-hmm. We hear stories all the time. It's interesting, but there's a long tradition of doctor writers, and I'm unprepared and can't think off the top of my head.
I just googled it.
There are a lot of them. Yeah, googled it. You could see the list.
William Carlos Williams.
Big famous one.
John Keats. Anton Chekhov. Mm-hmm. Arthur Conan Doyle.
Yep.
I don't know this one, but Mikhail Bulgakov.
Oh, I don't know him either.
Khalid Hosseini, the author of The Kite Runner,
yep.
1,000 Splendid
yep.
Sons.
Yep.
Yep. W. Somerset Maugham. Mom. I don't know how you pronounce the name, but Michael Crichton,
Michael Crichton.
That's the Jurassic Park franchise was his.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and, you're right. So you're joining a good list there.
Yeah. And now there's many more. I think more right doctors are writing now, and we haven't heard of all of them. The people haven't heard of me. They're not people heard of me, but there's a big there are a lot of people out there doing it. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but that's a good point. The stories that you hear that might inspire a book.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of them. If you're able to take the time and have the opportunity to really talk to people, talk to patients, and I'm sure that's not always possible because you have a lot of patients to see.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the things that I've found now that I've been in, had my own private practice for quite some time, and the intimacy that's developed between doctors and patients, and lots of other people too, and can be in through in the hospitals. But you know, when you get when you've known somebody for 10 years and you've seen them through a divorce and a child's illness and their own medical problems, it's a unique experience that people, you know, people, everybody knows what a doctor's all about. They think they've been to the doctor, but the from the doctor's end, it's a little bit different.
Yeah, can you speak to that a little more?
Like, yeah, well, and that's I think you know one of the things that had been in my mind as I was writing this book is really reaching out to strangers and being able to connect with strangers. And in this day and age when we're in the I don't know post Trump era, I'm not sure what era we're in at this moment in time, but but to we all have things that we've suffered through or that we've had difficulties, and most of us, many of us, are much more fortunate than others, but if you can find that in yourself and connect with your own small piece of challenge or difficulty in your life, you can talk to anybody and reach out to anybody. And I read on in a magazine on an airplane just last week about it, and I don't have the reference with me, but someone who used to be scared of strangers when he was a kid, and his father made him once a week they'd have pizza, and his father made him call the pizza place and have a conversation with the pizza man before he ordered anything, and he did this regularly. And then he wrote a book about how important it is to talk to strangers more recently. And I think that's anybody can do that. You don't have to be anybody special. You don't have to have a degree or a fancy profession. We can all reach out to people we don't know and make a connection.
I was going to say that's one of the most important things in the world today and sadly overlooked.
Mm-hmm. In the Care of Strangers, Dr. Khan, mm-hmm. Who you introduced in the where you read, is a psych rotator. Mm-hmm. And tell me a little more about what that means,
yeah.
and how that plays into the story.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I had to learn how to not to put in too much detail that people are going to get lost, but also put in enough that people understand. And I don't know that everybody really understands what a psych rotator is. But this is a teaching hospital. And so all the interns and residents are all trainees, and they've all graduated from medical school, but they're not fully formed doctors yet. And people in psychiatry have to spend a certain amount of time rotating as an intern on medical wards. I think maybe they had to do the whole first year back then. I can't remember. And so they're thrown in on the wards with all the other interns we had. We had dentists, you know, rotating through with us. I don't know who else we had, but people who end up going on to surgery, not so much surgery, but dermatology, gastroenterology. I mean, lots of people who end up in different specialties, not primary care at the end, spend time on the medical ward so that they can see a broad range of patients. And so Seema was Dr. Khan was a psych rotator. So she spent her whole first year on the medical wards. And you know, people pick different specialties for all sorts of different reasons. But if you're interested in psych, you're more interested in talking to people, and maybe you don't like to get your hands dirty or get too close to physically close to smelly people, which in an inner city hospital is unavoidable. But when you're an intern in that kind of a place, that's what you do. You get thrown in with it. So when there are references to the psych, the other interns didn't expect too much from her. You know, they don't necessarily expect that a psych intern's going to do very well, or they're going to be tough and they might make fun of the person. And, so she was an outsider. Dr. Khan was an outsider in that world too, because it wasn't where she hoped to be or wanted to be in the end.
And is that what drew Seema to her?
Yeah, she saw her as a sort of a, you know, maybe somebody she could be a role model, although there were, you know, issues. She wasn't sure she wanted to emulate this particular person. And then there's some stuff about hair, and she looks at her, you know, they have similar kind of curly dark hair, and she thinks, oh, you must be a Jew, you know, and she goes onto this whole thing about being a Jew and Jewish hair. And so, yeah, first she sees some similarities, and then she sees that Mindy is struggling at some point too. And Mindy has her own issues, as a psych rotator and being a doctor, and Seema can't understand, like, you know, what's with this woman? You know, Seema thinks she wants to be a doctor, and you know, this woman is struggling and doing some questionable things sometimes, and Seema doesn't know what that's all about. So they're kind of drawn together, and they seem to work. They're working. Seema is working double shifts so that she goes to school during the day sometimes, and so sometimes she works a double shift, and so she's in the hospital at night, which is when she has contact with Dr. Khan and the other interns more often than not.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Ellen Michelson, author of The Care of Strangers. So, when do you write?
When do I write?
And how do you write?
Yes.
And how do you write?
Do I use a pen and paper? Well, you know, the first draft was written longhand. I'm sure the very first early drafts. I don't draft so much anymore with a pen or paper. Well, I've set my schedule up to support my writing. I've been working part time for years so that I could write, and I tend to be more able to write earlier in the day. So my schedule is geared towards, you know, a couple days a week I get up in the morning and go to the computer and I write, and then I go to the office in the afternoon. And it sort of has evolved over time. So and I've got a little more free time at the beginning of the week to kind of jumpstart the writing week. And as the week goes on, I get a little more into the medical stuff. And I used to have trouble shifting back and forth. Now I'm probably going to have trouble shifting to the writing a little bit, because I haven't been writing much in the past number of months, and get back into that. But that's generally how I do it. And I keep, you know, I really have watched those, the hours that I've set aside for writing. I don't make other appointments. Tuesday and Thursday morning, I go to the gym or go out for a bike ride. But I've learned over time that used to take up too much time. It took me forever to get back to, you know, it'd be 2 o'clock in the afternoon when I was off on Tuesdays before I'd sit down at the computer. And I've, in the winter particularly, I now focus on 9 to 11, and I get home, and then I just make a beeline for the desk and sit there. So it still can be a little bit of a challenge sometimes, but I'm pretty strict about keeping to that schedule. And I don't, you know, unless it's something really emergent, I don't make an appointment during my writing time.
How long did you work on The Care of Strangers?
Off and on a long time. It's been probably 25 years or so. And yeah, it took me a long time for various reasons. And I took some time off. I wasn't writing all the time. I worked on some short stories. I did a little bit of nonfiction and published a piece of nonfiction and creative nonfiction, which also won a prize. Why did it take so long? I mean, it's a good question.
I didn't ask that question.
People ask in 25 years. That's a long time. I did do an event with two other friends of mine, who another woman, it was her second novel. It took her 25 years to get her book out for different reasons. And the other woman had submitted her book 38 times to publishers. So we talked about persistence and what it takes. And I didn't really know what I was doing. I was writing, I was in a workshop. And when I started writing, everything in the 80s was minimalism. And I kind of wanted to be Amy Hempel, though I didn't really and still don't fully understand how Amy Hempel does what she does. And then somewhere along the line in this group, I started writing. I made a list of quirky things that happened, and I started writing, and I'd write for about 3 months, and then I'd run out of material, and then I'd have to make another quirky list. It took me a long time to figure it out, and I had to write about physicality, which I was good at doing, but I didn't quite understand. I knew things had to happen, and so there was always something that happened in every little chapter that I wrote, but the through line, I didn't really understand who this has to have a through line. There has to be more emotionality. I mean, now people tell me when they read this, they can really feel the emotions and they feel what Seema is going through. And initially, I wasn't so good at that. And it took me a long time to figure out that was missing and how to do it. And finally, I was just, in the final drafting of the book before I submitted it to contests, I just said, just let Ziba say stuff, whatever. She just let it out. And then, you know, I did that. And then, you know, then I could work with it afterwards. But if it took a long time for me to get out of that minimalist thing that everything had to be just shown and not told, and characters couldn't say things. And, you know, I don't know why. I was just stuck in that mold for a very long time.
How did you know when you were finished, when the book was ready to go out?
Well, interestingly, it was a couple of years ago, a friend said, have you published that novella of yours? And I said, oh, no. And I'd given up thinking of it as a novella, because everybody had a different definition of novella. It could be 10,000 words, 20,000 words, 40,000 words, whatever. And she said, you got to enter this contest. And I looked and I said, well, you know, they only want to see the first 25 pages. I said, okay, I'll just send them that. And then I was shortlisted and had 10 days to cut out 10,000 words because it was too long. Their contest was 40,000 words, and I think I had 47,000 words. So I was determined, and I took out 10,000 words. But then I realized, well, I took out stuff, which is good, the stuff I took out, but more stuff needed to go back in. And so I submitted it, and I figured it's not going to win anything. But then I spent the next 3 months putting things back and really looking at structure. You know, I really didn't want to know about structure for a long time. I just was resistant to it. And then finally I said, okay, you know, here's part one, part two, part three. I labeled them part one, part two, part three. I looked at all the different chapters. I moved a few things around. And then I let Seema just talk, let her spit out some things. And when I did that, at that point, I realized, okay, I've taken as far as I can. It's ready. And then I sent it out, and then I found the contest for the De Groot Prize, and I guess I submitted it to some other things too. And then 6 months later, you know, it won. But I really felt at that point that it was ready. You know, it was ready. It still needed more work, of course. Whenever you get to an editor's hands, my editor wanted to remove the little chapter about the Haitian AIDS patient, and I knew that wasn't going to go, but it was in the wrong place, and it didn't fit where it went. And so I ended up moving it from the beginning of a section. I think it was section two or part two, and it moved to the end. And then she said, oh, this really works. This is good.
Oh, good.
But
oh,
that's
good.
Another thing you learn too, going through an MFA and working with a lot of different people, you develop a thick skin, and you also learn you are the writer. Oh, no one really knows what you're writing about except you, and you have to hold true to you. If you hear the same thing from a bunch of people, well, there's that something's an issue. You need to listen to that. But you have to hold on to your own guns as to what's important and where you want to go with things.
When did you do the MFA?
I did the MFA about 10 years ago, I guess. I think I finished in 2010, at Pacific University. And I did that because I'd been working on this book with a writing group, and it was led by Tom Spanbauer. But I knew I needed to learn some things about the novel and about writing that I couldn't do by myself anymore. And so I applied to MFA. And MFA is a low residency, which means we didn't go to a campus. We weren't there all the time. So it was something you could do and still work. I mean, it was a little challenging. I basically worked and wrote, and that's about it. You know, I didn't have time for much of anything else. But we would go for 10 days, either to the campus. In the winter time, we went to Cannon Beach in a hotel on the Portland and the Oregon coast, and we'd have lectures and workshops. And then the rest of the time we'd work independently with a writer and work on. So it was, you know, it's kind of perfect for distance kind of thing. And for with the COVID now too. And we'd submit pages, and we had to read a lot. And we had to read 20 books. I think they've cut back on that since now. That was a lot, but we were supposed to read 20 books a semester and write little stuff about the 20 books, or maybe not all of them. We had to write about a certain number. But you know, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to write and read. I wasn't interested in going back to school for anything else. I'd had enough school. but I, you know, I really made some big changes at that time and learned a lot of things.
And But you weren't able to complete the novel then.
No, I worked my thesis advisor was Bonnie Jo Campbell, who's a wonderful writer and a wonderful woman, and we went through about the first half of it because a lot of MFA programs work on short stories because it's much easier to finish a whole short story and work on that. But I was very stubborn and I was going to work on my novel. Lots of people are working on novels in this program, but they weren't at the time. And so then she handed me over to a woman who was her editor, as an editor and friend of hers, and that I went through the full draft, the rest of it with her. And actually, I think I went through two drafts. But, you know, that still wasn't done at that point in time, but it was further done than it had been. So and then I was in different work with some different groups at other times. But I don't know if not that many people had read the whole thing. And in the end, and when I did the final revision, I was doing it on my own. I didn't show it to anybody. So no one saw it until it went to my editor. And there it was.
Quite a process, and I'm sure that some people who would love to write get discouraged because of the process, but I'm glad that you didn't.
Yeah, it is discouraging, and it is a very long process, and there's no guarantee of anything. I think I was always, over the years when I finished my MFA, I was sending things out. I actually started sending the book out to some agents and contests after I worked with this private editor. I was a finalist in about six contests, and several agents said, oh, they really liked the material. They liked the setting. There was something about Seema that they weren't quite in love with her enough, whatever, that's what they always say. And the through line, there were some issues. Yeah, they all say that. I don't love your book enough to represent you. But I got encouragement, you know, and then I'd get a few little things published. And so I would say, oh, why am I bothering, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, something, little thing would happen, and it would encourage me to keep going.
Mm-hmm. Now, was the publication part of, was the prize
yes.
for
mm-hmm. yeah.
for the contest?
Yeah, it was wow. publication. And there are novels, small novels, literary novels, often there are a number of contests. First I didn't think there were very many, but then I realized, oh yeah, there are a lot of contests. And, so publication is often the prize. I mean, you know, initially before I did the final revision, I was, you know, I was a finalist about six times or a semifinalist. And I thought, well, this is great, but it's not a book contract. And I was getting a little weary of it, and I wasn't going to submit to any more contests. And then when I realized, oh, I have a novella, okay, I'll submit to some novella contest. But I was kind of tired of that. But, you know, many people, I think there were 500 entrants to this contest. And so, you know, probably, you know, good half of them were not near quality that I was really competing with. But, you know, my next step, if this hadn't worked, I was figuring that year I was going to spend submitting to small presses. So, but, you know, small press or any press, you get in, they read your book, and you're not competing with 500 people. I mean, you're competing with in a different kind of a framework. But
right,
the contests
right.
are tough in because of that. But, you know, some of it's timing and luck and having the right judge. Justin Torres was the judge for this contest, and he wrote a wonderful book called We the Animals. I'm saying that right, We the Animals. and I thought when I saw that, I thought, oh, he'd be a good person for this book. And turns out he was. And he gave me a wonderful introduction when I did a recorded, pre-recorded event. I was supposed to go to the Miami Book Fair and get to read and hubnub with all these great people. And that didn't happen in November 2020. But everything was pre-recorded, and you know, the fancy writers got to do some Q&A, live Q&A. They said we were going to, but that didn't happen. But Justin gave me an incredible introduction before I did my thing, and I met him years before at a reading, and he signed my book, saying, "I hope I read your book someday." I should have emailed him because I've never gotten the chance to thank him for that.
Well, congratulations, Ellen. We're actually out of time.
Yeah.
And so we need to wrap up, but I want to thank you for being with us today. And Mom, do you have some closing words?
Yes, I do. To me, this book demonstrates what kindness can do. And Mark Twain once said, "Kindness is the language which the deaf can hear and the blind can see."
Thank you, and good luck with your next book.
Thank you, and thank you very much for having me. This was wonderful.
And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.